Dixie is split on most everything. The LRP controls the legislature, but lost some ground, and Governor Drunk seems to have gone hands-off. Both sides are fighting for control. Kevin Fever, and this is The Weekly. I've said it before and I'll say it again. My intention really is to have this show be weekly and not once every few months. Hopefully I'll be back on track now. Today I'm thrilled to have on Congressman Bacon and Moonkai, who have some very different perspectives on the state of their state and on the national parties. I also got to chat a bit with Moonkai about his mayoral bid and what he and others on the left have taken to calling the steal in the last presidential election, which I criticized him quite a bit on. At the end, I gave myself a little bit of time for a mini rant on dishonest media groups and the need for transparency in publishing. But before all that, Congressman Bacon. Congressman Bacon, welcome to The Weekly.
Thank you for having me. It's truly an honor to be here.
Glad we could get you in. Can we just get us started? For those who don't pay a ton of attention to state politics, or at least politics that aren't their state, what has been going on in Dixie? Because obviously you're a congressman on the federal level, but also you're perhaps more widely known for your role in the Dixie Assembly. So you could just catch us up there on the last couple of weeks.
Well, Dixie has been seeing a large wave of change over the past not only couple months but also the past couple weeks. There's been many reversals of former radical left-wing policy at the hands of the LRP, and we've recently lost a seat to the said left, and we're currently coping with that loss, and I think we're handling it well, and we're looking on to a good session coming in. I think we'll have lots of legislation passed that will greatly help the people of Dixie. Looking on to the budget in the soon future, we are hoping to pass more tax cuts for Dixons of all classes, to help reinvigorate the ailing economy. And that's about it.
Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong. The seat loss resulted, the right still has a majority in the assembly, but you lost the ability to override vetoes unless you pick up a vote from the left. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Does that change your strategy at all? Because prior to that seat being flipped, obviously you and the right more or less had the public backing to put through the policy that you felt needed to be implemented. Now that that has been checked a bit, is there more communication with the left caucus in the assembly or with the governor's office? How has that changed how you and your caucus operate?
Well, let's just be clear. I mean, we are listeners in the LRP, okay? We have always listened to the governor. We have always listened to the minority, even when we had a supermajority. Now, we disagreed a lot, and, you know, at the end of the day, we passed what we wanted, what our constituents voted us in for, but we always listened, and we will continue to listen. We will work with the governor, with the minority caucus on the upcoming budget. We will work together on legislation to produce a bipartisan effort, as we always have, as we've always tried. I hope that the left's partisanship will change, seeing the circumstances of the current assembly, but only time will tell.
Mm-hmm. How has your communication been with the governor? Because he's taken criticism somewhat recently that his presence has been less felt than it could have been and that it used to be. Have you been in regular contact for budget negotiations or any other pieces of legislation or actions on his level?
Well, to be perfectly honest, the governor has been absent in many talks throughout my time in the assembly. I mean, you know, in former budget talks, he has been there on occasion, but for most of the time, we've been talking with the minority caucus just to just due to the lack of communication that the governor has offered. Not to say we aren't open to it. If he wants to come to us to talk about the budget, we are more than welcome. Mm-hmm. But at this time, we are only talking with the minority caucus.
Okay. Right now, there is a resolution moving through the Senate and hopefully soon to head to the House that will lead to the reincorporation of Puerto Rico's territory into Dixie. How do you think that changes the calculus for upcoming elections with a few players coming back in and the number of seats that we're vying for on the federal level getting reduced?
The reincorporation of Puerto Rico is nothing but good, not only for the nation, but Dixie as well, and in my view, the Libertarian Republican Party. It'll bring major players in that we in the Dixie state politics will value their input. I see it as nothing but good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of changing the numbers on the federal level, obviously we're recording this Tuesday evening, so results came out recently that Sisseman beat out Alao for the Jefferson Senate seat, moving the Senate's composition to 5-3 in favor of the right. Puerto Rico's reincorporation would remove two right-aligned senators, bringing the Senate to 3-3 with Vice President Ian breaking the tie. Obviously, you're on the House level, so this is asking a little bit outside of your realm, but do you see a danger there in losing that chamber since the left does control the House? Since just it seems that the right's Senate numbers are kind of getting chipped away one by one.
It is, as a voter, it is a little scary, but with my you know, quote unquote insider knowledge, being a member of the party, I think we're looking good. The senators we have, the senators up for re-election, this next federal election, I think they're in a really good position right now, mm-hmm. and I think we will hold the Senate, if not gain a seat.
Okay. Where do you see that potential pickup being?
Well, honestly, it could be anywhere. I mean, there, you know, the left has nothing but weak candidates in the Senate. I mean, you saw just last federal election, they didn't run anybody. Mm-hmm. Their game in the Senate is really, really lacking, and I think they have everything to lose when it comes to Senate elections.
So you don't see a concerning trend coming out of Sisseman's victory?
I do not. That personally, I blame that on the chaos in the Jefferson LRP. Representative Sorens screw up really, really created a chaos within that state. We're currently working on rebuilding it and recovering it, but that election was solely on him.
Okay, let's talk about that a bit, because Soren was a part of LRP leadership before he removed himself from the party, citing issues with President Elkridge's foreign policy. Now, you run the Atlanta Tribune, and in the wave of media coverage, somewhat opportunistically, I would say, predicting the downfall of the Libertarian Republicans, you push back on that. Can you just explain why this series of exits that we've seen from the party is not a concern in your view?
All right, let's look at those who left the party. Okay, that is Representatives Purdy, Miguel, and Representative Soren. Mm-hmm. These are all recent members. They joined right before the last federal election, during the downfall of the former SDP, and they were looking for an opportunity. They saw it and they grabbed it. They used the party, frankly, to get their seats, and they're nothing but opportunists. They left. Why? Because they're nothing but opportunists. They didn't want the quote unquote bad press on the Uckridge administration to reflect on them. So they left with, you know, their tail between their legs. It's not surprising. You know, personally, I even expected it from one or two of them. I mean, the LRP isn't dying, you know. Mm-hmm. We're stronger than ever. We hold the Senate. We hold the White House. We hold two out of the, or three, I guess, if we count Puerto Rico, out of the four states. We're stronger than ever right now, and I see nothing but new heights on the horizon.
Okay. So, yeah, like you pointed out, Miguel and Purdy were both former members of the Workers' Party. Sorin was formerly, I believe, SDP, which I should fact check, but I don't have time to look at records right now, so take that one with a grain of salt. But he was formerly of another party and entered the LRP. Two threads to go from there. At what point would you start becoming concerned about the longevity of the LRP? Is that when some of the more core, consistently right-wing people start showing signs of flaking? Or is there another line in the sand where you're kind of looking for, or are you just not concerned about it at all right now?
I do not think there is any threat of decay in the party. Mm-hmm. We have a base of new members coming in, even in Dixie, my home state. You can see in the assembly we have members who have not ascended to the House or Senate or federal government as a whole yet. You know, they're ready. They are ready to go. You know, they haven't gone yet. You know, I mean, the youth of our party is ready. It's forming. It's coming. You know, I don't think there is any decay within the party. I don't think any more members will leave, any relevant members, I should specify. I think we're in a good shape. I think we're in a good place right now.
Okay. Your response to that ties a little bit into the second portion of my question, which is, even taking, if we accept that the three members who have left in a high profile way, we're always on the outs, we're more opportunistic than ideologically aligned with the party at any point. Taking that and putting that aside, those were still pretty valued numbers, I would think, when it comes to votes on the House level, on the state levels. So if the issue that we have right now is that we're filling in, we as the LRP, if the LRP is having issues filling the ranks and filling campaigns with people, and they can't get by without using those who are kind of on the outs. What is the strategy now to get both working majorities and majorities that the party can rely on, rather than people who use it and then flake?
I do not think the current system in our politics of a duopoly is sustainable. You will always have these opportunities, these opportunists, these people on the outskirts that will clench onto these parties and use them only to flake off and go to other parties. I think we will see the rise of another party and eventually return to the state we had just a couple months ago, where we had five or six major parties that would run in a variety of elections across the states. Mm-hmm.
Where do you see those fault lines happening? If you're satisfied that the LRP is in a safe place, that you're not going to be losing additional members, where do you see, let's put aside five or six, but let's just start with one more. Where do you see a third party developing? Who would that encompass? Not necessarily naming names, but just what is the portion of the electorate and of the politicians that would be brought into that?
Well, it's those who are in the middle. I mean, I hate to say that because it's such a cliche, but It is. I mean, the left is so divided, you know, you have so many different positions. There are some that just cannot align with the mainstream GLP right now. And the same goes for the LRP. You know, you just had some moderates, in one case you could even say left-wing case, of leaving the party because our economic policy is too far to the right. These people in the middle, I could see, could form the next party.
Mm-hmm. All right, I believe that is all I had prepared. Do you have anything else you'd like to touch on or speak to our audience about while I have you here?
No, I don't believe I do. I mean, no, I don't think I do.
All right, Congressman Bacon, thank you again for coming on.
All right, thank you for having me.
Congressman Boomguy, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for inviting me.
Of course, glad we could get you back in here. So you are obviously just now, as we're recording on Wednesday evening, you've wrapped up the DC mayoral race. Can you talk a bit about what drew you back to DC and why you think this is your moment? Obviously, now you're not making much of a case to voters since that's done and over with, but what brought you to the race?
Well, DC has always been close to my heart ever since I was a councilman, and there's no question that it has a severe lack of strong, solid leadership. I believe in the mayoral realm it was better, but Elkridge's insane economic policy has left us completely dependent on the federal government, and so we need a change to our tax policy, we need to change to our health policy. I believe I could be the person who gives that.
Mm-hmm. Now, DC is kind of unique in the sense that it is somewhat known for not having experienced policymakers, experienced politicians involved in the council there. When you say that, like, obviously, you coming in, assuming you win the race, comes with some sort of a mandate. However, the DC council is not really subject to that mandate. It's more the whims of who comes and goes at any given day. So how do you plan on working with the council, regardless of the makeup, to push these policies that you are claiming a mandate for?
Right. So when I was councilor, the council was a bit more active, but it was still tough. You had to talk with the council member. And what I learned is that these people, inexperienced, they don't really know what they want. But if you have a good conversation with them, you can try and convince them, and they're mostly very reasonable people. I believe if I do become elected mayor, I could convince them to pass all of these great things for the district.
Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile, in some ways, this what you consider pretty reasonable and convincible council, one that would side with you on reforms, being the same format of a council and same type of makeup that passed what you consider Elkridge's insane policies?
Well, I believe that mayors can convince council people because of their inexperience of bad things. Things like the one tax policy seemed nice in the first glance, but when you look at it deeply, you can see it's very hurtful for poor farmers and for real estate landowners.
Mm-hmm.
And so on.
Let's talk a little bit about your opponent in the race. John Smith has a bit of a history, both as a politician and on this podcast. I think he was one of our more lively guests in the past. How do you feel about your chances against him in the race, and what might DC be facing if he were to come out on top?
I think John Smith's politics are politics of division, not of unity. He has been Islamophobic, and in our debate he refused to apologize for calling Muhammad a pedophile or saying Islam is a non-liberal and a horrible religion. And he chalks it up to difference of opinion, and it's not. It's very harmful to our people. Our city is a very diverse city. It's a welcome of inclusion. And his fight against Islam and his attempt to invade Mexico and his opposition of any race-inclusive policy hurt the people of the district. So that's what I think his mayor would be like. And it's not good.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to Dixie a little bit. Now, I had Congressman Bacon on. We recorded, I suppose it was yesterday now. But he was, in some ways, like we discussed the recent left-wing pickup in the Dixie Assembly and how that kind of changes the right's leverage within that legislative body. What is your outlook right now for the state of Dixie? How would you assess what's happening right now in the state?
Well, I was obviously before this election was hopeful we'll take more of a pickup, but I believe the fact that we did manage to keep a veto-proof minority means that Dixie knows the LRP is policies are not what they're promising. They're not tax cuts and utopia. They're actually very bad for the people of DC. They're cutting healthcare. They're cutting healthcare, they're cutting housing, they're cutting education. And I think with this budget, if the LRP will be cooperative, because we have more of a leverage, we can reverse some of the worst things they've done in the past few months. So I'm quite optimistic.
Okay. Can I ask, and I want to push just a little bit, you say they're pushing, like the people of Dixie recognize that the LRP is pushing policies that are bad for Dixie. How do you reconcile that with the people of Dixie choosing an LRP majority? Do you say that they're voting for bad policy, voting for policy they know will hurt them? Because it seems like what you're describing is the voters sort of shooting a gap of not giving the left power, but giving them just enough to not give the right all the power.
Right. Well, Dixie trusted in the right in large margins and four districts. But this time, even their wins, they were very, very slim. As you know, Representative James only barely passed in a margin after he campaigned in the wrong district. And he clearly showed a lack of care for the people, and they showed that by only barely passing him. And I do understand why they don't trust the left easily, because of things like the convention, but I do believe they are seeing the harm of the LRP, and that's why they're less enthusiastic, and I believe we can capture the state in the October election.
Okay. When we were discussing having you on the show, I always ask before guests come on, are there specific things that you would want to discuss? And one of the things you mentioned right off the bat was what you call, quote unquote, the steal. Can you go into a little bit why that is still a driving force for you in Dixie?
Well, there's no doubt that the steal, as some are calling it, is one of the things that show most the utter desperation and utter lack of any sort of conscience of some of the assembly people in Dixie. What they did was they pushed through in 4 minutes a taking of 48% of Dixians' voice, just like that. They say dictatorship of the majority is something they want to avoid. That's why they oppose abolishing the Electoral College, but just like that, they killed 48% of Dixians. If Elkridge wouldn't have won a majority, which is very close to doing, they would have taken the voice of a majority of Dixians. And they did it through appointing a person who they now call Lino because he left them. And it just shows that they're opportunists and they'll stop at nothing to just harm the people of Dixie as much as possible. Truly one of the saddening and disgusting things that I've seen in my time as a politician.
Okay, I have a few follow-up questions there. So just to establish a bit of a baseline, do you believe that President Elkridge is currently seated fairly and legally?
Legally, surely. I don't know about fair. I don't think presidential elections are required to be fair. If it was a fair world, I think things would be quite differently. But I do think that what they did after the people of Dixie already had voted was completely dangerous for our democracy.
Okay. A second follow-up there. Is it fair to assume that you believe that whoever wins the popular vote should win the bulk of electors? Is that a safe assessment?
Yes, I do believe we should go on a ranked choice national vote, and whoever wins the majority in the final round should be the president of the United States.
Okay, so do you acknowledge that Elkridge won the plurality of votes nationwide?
Plurality, but if I remember correctly, not a majority.
That is correct, but under the system we have, he won the plurality. Did he win the plurality in Dixie?
Oh, yes. He's the fair and he's the president, and I completely respect that he was elected by the rules that we granted.
No, I'm trying to establish point by point here, just so we're clear, because I think to editorialize a little bit on my end, calling it the steal seems deceptive to voters. It implies that an election that should have gone another way was taken from the people who should have won, from the candidates that should have won. And by every assessment that I can see, Elkridge won Dixie, he won nationwide, and he won the bulk of the Electoral College. So in what way was this election stolen from anyone else? I guess that's the best question.
First,
who was the election stolen from?
The steal was not a word I invented.
But it is something. When we discussed before the podcast here, you approached it as the steal, and that is a modicum that has widely been used in the media, including by you.
Yes, the reason I think that is a name people are using is because the potential of a steal of Dixie. Without a person without a majority winning all of its electors. Secondly, it's because this was done after the people of Dixie already voted. They did not know of this to be the chance. So people who voted April may have not voted April if they had known that Dixie was winner take all. So you could say that votes of other candidates were stolen, and that's why I think they called it that way.
So I want to compare here, and I'm sorry to push on this, but that is the phrase "the steal" has irked me ever since I started hearing it, and this is the first time I've gotten someone in here to really talk through it. So I apologize that you're the victim of that today. Here's my real question, and I think this is where it comes in when people say after the votes were. After the votes were cast. Is it taking the election? I would be totally on board with the case you are making if it was after the votes were tallied and we knew the percentages and we knew that taking the action that the Dixie LRP did in changing the allocation of electors would flip this many electors from one candidate to another. I can see that. But unless you are claiming that they had advanced knowledge of the vote totals, it seemed like this wasn't in any way guaranteed to benefit their candidate or another candidate or any candidate.
I don't think they knew that, but what they did know through polls, they saw that, and through predictions, it was fairly clear to most people that Elkridge would at very least win a plurality. You saw that in every prediction. And secondly, Dixie had been pretty strongly right recently before that. So I think it was fairly reasonable for the Dixie LRP to predict that Elkridge would win a plurality of the people. They didn't know if they would win a majority, and that may be the reason they decided after the votes were cast to change the rules.
Okay. I maintain my disagreements with that, but I appreciate you talking through it with me. The last thing we discussed mentioning was the, and you brought up what some have called winos, which is the libertarians in name only. And I discussed this with Bacon
like
as well.
That
a
name,
bit. No, I don't particularly either. It doesn't roll off the tongue. Particularly because now that we're in the Libertarian Republican Party, it's a strange assumption that everyone in that coalition is a libertarian. That's in some ways why it was broadened out, to my understanding, although I think that was before I really re-entered the political world at all. But you brought that up. And where do you see the trajectory of, I'll say, the right in general moving? Do you see after I recorded with Bacon, Congressman and Puerto Rico Assemblyman Ethan Matias left the party as well. He was formerly of the SDP. Just to kind of clear the timeline here, because that was after Bacon and I talked and there were only three at the time. So now we're up to four people who have left.
Yes.
Where do you see the trajectory of the party and the right in general going, considering these recent individuals who have chosen to leave?
Well, the LRP has invested the past few months in trying to build it up as a big tent, trying to take former SDP members and former WP members to its sort of tent. But the actions of President Elkridge especially have shown to the people outside of the sort of base of the LRP the presidency and the LRP in general supporting it, it means that they'll be more war hawkish, the right in general, that seems to be the trajectory, and they'll be more fervently supporting the president. There doesn't seem to be a place within the tent of the LRP for sort of reaching out and compromising anymore. That seems to be sort of taken. And I think that more and more moderate people will abandon the LRP, maybe towards a new party, maybe towards a GLP, maybe just the independent. But that's what I think the trajectory. Unless the LRP rethink how they do things, rethink the war hawks, rethink their abandonment of moderates.
It's funny that you mentioned a third party, because that came up in my earlier discussion as well. Do you primarily see, because it's relatively rare in recent history to see a two-party system, if a third party did develop, do you think it would be most likely that it is individuals who have split off from the right under Elkridge leading that charge, or is there another fracture that you possibly see forming in the political coalitions that would lead to a third party?
I think some of the more moderate left-wing people who are still within the left coalition don't always exactly like the GLP. We have a very certain ideology. We would never hit that. So I think they might be likely to form a party within the coalition still. But the other side really is either LRPers who left the LRP because of Elkridge, or a sort of socialist party, which the WP was the last of which, of a long line.
What do you see as the prospects for a particularly left-wing party? And I only bring that up, I hadn't really plan that out ahead of time, but just looking at the people who have left the LA Prairie, we have two of the four that have been kind of lauded over the last few days. Miguel and Purdy were former Workers' Party high up in the ranks. So I think it's a fair argument that they were always something of a rough fit for the LRP. And obviously the two others were a bit more moderate and could potentially carve themselves a path in there. But do you see that group charting themselves left of the GLP and making them more of the center party just by necessity? Or is that not necessarily in the cards right now with the GLP sort of widening to accept the fall of the left coalition?
I think we in the GLP still would be sort of hesitant to accept people like Miguel and Ethan because they don't really fall in the similar ideology to the GLP. But I think that they very much well have room in the left coalition to support reform. And these are people who have been in the past dedicated to reforming our economic and social systems. So everyone who agrees with that have plenty of room within the left coalition.
Okay. Last question that I have for you, and I don't hesitate. I apologize for springing this on you, but I feel like I can't avoid it at this point. It seems there's been plenty of speculation. It seems that you are beginning to position yourself for a potential run to replace Governor Drunk in Dixie. Is that in the cards?
I'm not at all sure. I've been thinking of that, obviously, but nothing is for certain.
Okay. Would you consider a primary challenge, or was it simply if he were to step aside, you would consider filling those shoes?
I think Drunk has been an incredible governor, and I would still support him so long as he wants to be governor.
Okay. That's all I have. Is there anything else you would like to discuss or speak to the audience about?
I think that this election in D.C. is a fundamental choice between reform and divisive politics. I think when you go to the ballots, if you can vote, you need to remember the difference, and you need to know if you want DC to continue progressing or if you want to go behind.
All right, Congressman Mungai, thank you again for coming on.
Thank you very much, Governor. I've been happy to be here.
I don't usually do editorial segments on this show. I prefer the interview setup where I try and take questions from both myself and from listeners to the podcast and try and learn what politicians are thinking. But at the end of the day, the show has my name on it, and I don't think it will come as a huge shock to anyone if some of my perspective makes it through. Today I'm going to make that a bit more explicit through a brief bit of commentary. From the day that I started TBR, I've had a commitment to transparency. When I write stories that involve myself, I always clearly state that I run the publication. People that work for TBR do not write stories that involve themselves. And if I'm going to run a story about changing opinions in the political world, I always, always source those arguments. Now, if you keep half an eye on my Twitter, you've probably noticed a pet peeve that I've been harping on the last couple of weeks. That being media groups that are citing nameless blobs of voters, or just Americans in general, that are lining up behind that organization's viewpoints. A couple notable examples. The Perspective, which opened its doors a couple weeks ago, is run by former Governor Lena Caffey, who is a member of the GLP. He made the case that the LRP has taken a recent turn toward the Republican half of that name, and the supposed change is, quote, leaving many LRP supporters wondering where the Libertarian and Libertarian Republican Party has gone. Excuse me. He's welcome to make this case. I'm not bashing that at all. That's a perfectly okay opinion to hold. It is vital to source this feeling if you're going to put forward that actual supporters are feeling this way and not the author of the article. There's a lot of people that are more than willing to talk about their beliefs, so find one and actually get their feelings. Because simply stating that a large group of people agree with you is dishonest and misleading to your readers. In another example, the Workers' Press, which is run by Jefferson MP Freedom, another GOP member, published an article stating that the American people are starting to see that President Elkridge and the LRP have failed them. I don't need to repeat that whole thing that I just said about the previous previous organization. What people, source them, find a quote, one person, and build your argument around that. This isn't even granting anonymity, which I have my own separate issues with that maybe I'll do another rant on in another episode. This is just Freedom pretending to know the public opinion when they clearly don't. They don't provide information to show that what they're saying is supported in fact, supported in polling. They're just trying to make the case by pretending, without evidence, that there are a large group of people that support their perspective. It's not that hard of an ask. Just be honest with your readers or your listeners or viewers, whatever you're putting out, whoever's seeing your material. State your biases when you publish. Source your quotes. Put in some actual work if you're going to claim to do journalism. Or alternatively, don't say you're doing journalism and just simply state clearly that what you're doing is an opinion piece while attaching your name to your work. That is valuable. I've run them before. People have every right to see different opinions. It's a good thing. But when you're not clearly marking them as opinion and you are writing things in a way that makes it seem like you have more information than you do about who agrees with you, it's dishonest. People deserve to have information they can trust. It is on members of the media to provide that information. We'll be right back. Here's what else you need to know this week. Both parties appear to be gearing up for a fight over the federal budget, with the left-controlled House arguing that the president is not engaged in negotiations over the funding bill. Elkridge has scheduled a presser with LRP congressional leadership, where they are expected to unveil their budget proposal. A divided Congress suggests that neither side will likely draw major policy wins from the budget, but it remains to be seen whether the traditional constraints around the bill, what the right's long dubbed their red lines, will be challenged, or whether the left is willing to risk a government shutdown to force their priorities into the bill. Puerto Rican reincorporation may finally become a reality as the bill to authorize the new state of Dixie has reached the president's desk. It is expected that Elkridge will sign the bill, though the two states involved, Dixie and Puerto Rico, must also pass versions before reincorporation is complete. As always, remember to subscribe wherever you listen to the show. All are welcome to contact me, Kevin Fever, with stories you'd like to see covered or guest suggestions for future episodes. The Weekly is a public record podcast.